I'm Chuck Lutz, and tonight's forum is on the subject of worship language, inclusiveness in language. And I put as a heading on the board, which you probably cannot read because the markers don't work very well, a line from a hymn. It's actually from O Sacred Head Now Wounded, What Language Shall I Borrow? And I think that's kind of a keynote question for our discussion tonight. We'll go for as long as people want to talk. If the tape runs out after 60 minutes, so be it. But we can keep talking for as long as any of you wish to continue. The introductory words that I want to say as a kind of setting for our conversation include this suggestion, that we not limit our conversation tonight to gender issues. Gender issues are very important, but I would like to suggest that there are other issues as well in the question of the language by which we worship. And I've put some of those categories on the board. Sexism is one, we'll use isms. Sexism is certainly one, but another one is the category of racism / imperialism. Included in that would be the way the northern world looks at the southern world, or our colonial heritage. A third category is that of militarism and nationalism, which is something that's still present in quite a bit of our worship texts that we use. And a fourth category, which I've labeled archaism. That's the these thous, lettest, and givest, and that kind of line. And there are some other examples, which I'll allude to in a minute. We want to talk about all of that, and probably some that aren't on the board that may occur to you. It's a subject about which people have very deep feelings, because I think the worship language becomes a part of us, as does language in general. It shapes who we are as human creatures. In a sense, it creates us, language does. If we need any reminder of the importance of worship language with which we are raised and nurtured in the faith, I don't think we have to look any farther than Catherine Kolb. Some of you will remember when Catherine Kolb returned from Iran after 444 days as a hostage. She said the one thing that sustained her throughout her time there was her falling back in memory on what she could recall of hymnody and psalmody and liturgical material that she had grown up with in a small rural Lutheran church in Iowa. And I think that's true for probably most of us in this room. If we had the books taken away from us and we were forced to rely on what we could recall, for many of us, what we would rely on is the recollection of scripture and worship materials. And that, she said, became her worship life, her sustenance during the time she was held in Iran. Let me just, before I introduce the two who are going to make some opening comments about their own orientation to this subject, let me just mention some, under each of these categories, some examples. Some years ago, when we moved from the Red Book, the Service Book and Hymnal, to the Green Book, I was part of a task force that was asked to look at the language of the hymn section that was proposed for the LBW. And we were asked, as people who worked professionally with language, there were poets, there were writers there, to make suggestions to the final hymn selection committee about what should be in, what should be out, and of those that might stay in the final collection, what kinds of language changes, if any, did we recommend? And so I'm drawing on some of that, my recollection of that experience in this, what I'm now going to say. Under sexism, I remember that we struggled with faith of our fathers and with children of the Heavenly Father. What should we do with those? This was a time when, mid-70s, when we were starting to become rather sensitive to the, at least the human issues in gender language. We weren't so sensitive to the God language side of it. That came a little later. Our group recommended that we keep faith of our fathers and children of the Heavenly Father on the grounds that they were so familiar to so many people that it would be foolhardy to try to change them. However, we did recommend changing Rise Up, O Men of God, and it was changed. Anybody know what it was changed to?
Saints.
Rise Up, O Saints of God. And I don't think there were any people who were deeply troubled by that. Partly because Rise Up, O Men of God wasn't of that long standing among us, wasn't that familiar, wasn't that well known. But the things that were better known, we felt, were probably more difficult to tamper with. Under Racism, Imperialism, we recommended that From Greenland's Icy Mountains be dropped. And it was. It's in the Red Book. If you miss it, you can find it here. It's not in the Green Book. Why was it dropped? Well, it was dropped because of language like this. Can we whose souls are lighted with wisdom from on high, can we to men benighted the lamp of life deny? And all through the hymn, there's that kind of implication of those of us who are in on it are in some sense superior to those who aren't. It was just not the kind of language in the late 20th century that we thought should be in a hymnal. There's another one that's in the Red Book, it's not in the Green Book, called Remember All the People. There's a line in it you may recall, talks about the people in far-off lands and has this line, where apes swing to and fro. Remember that? That's gone, it's not in the Green Book. Under militarism and nationalism, this is where we had maybe the deepest emotional commitment to some hymns that our group recommended be dropped, and they were not. We recommended the dropping of the Son of God goes forth to war, which doesn't seem quite to fit Jesus the peacemaker, that imagery, but that's a hymn. It's still in this book. I haven't sung it for years because in my congregation we haven't used it, but it's in there, and maybe some of you are still singing it. We also recommended dropping Onward Christian Soldiers and Stand Up for Jesus, Ye Soldiers of the Cross, because of their military imagery. In a poll that was taken of the congregations, a sample of congregations, prior to the final locking up of the collection, what would be in this canon, Onward Christian Soldiers and Stand Up for Jesus finished in the top 10. They're very popular. They were not dropped. A Mighty Fortress. Some attack it for its fortress battle military imagery. But it's still in here, and I expect it will always be in some form in Lutheran collections of hymnody.
You keep going, I got nothing to say.
Okay, finally, under archaisms, I fain would take my stand. You remember that from Beneath the Cross of Jesus? That was changed to I long to take my stand. Behold a host arrayed in white, for some reason was changed to Who is this host arrayed in white? I still don't know why that change was made. O Master, let me walk with thee became O Master, let me walk with you. To my ears, it just doesn't seem right. It doesn't feel right. We did not go all the way with thee and thou language. The other night here in Vespers, we sang In Thee is Gladness. So we've kept some and we've dropped others. I think a lot of those decisions were made on the basis of how the deciding committee felt about how far they could go. And that's what we want to talk about tonight. And Susan Sherwin, who is also known as Luigi, she tells me, is going to talk first about the matter of how far we can go or how far we should go, in her opinion. She is from Park Ridge, Illinois. She is a musician and poet, and I talked with her earlier today. She said she had some strong feelings about this subject, as I think all of us do, and she's going to share some of them now. Susan.
Thank you. We're formed by our language, whether we're conscious of it or not. The way we speak, the words we use, the metaphors we use form us. They form our beliefs, and our beliefs form our language as well. It's a circle, and it's a cycle. As our ideologies are transformed, our language has to be transformed to fit the ideologies so that we can be transformed. Because whether we're aware of it or not, the words that are constantly filling us and infiltrating us affect us and form us. We need to take great care with the words that we choose. And our metaphors need to change as our understanding changes. As our understanding of things of God changes, our words need to change. Behold, I make all things new. This doesn't just go for the church. This goes for us, our symbols, our words, our metaphors, our speech, our actions, even those things that are dear to us. Our new crafters of liturgy and hymns and confessional texts need to reflect our changes in our understanding in their texts. But, as Pee Wee Herman says, everybody I know has a big but. But, I think that we're in danger of several things at this juncture. We are so eager to change our language that we are often using texts that are inclusive because they're inclusive and not because they're excellent. For example, with much respect to Ruth Duck and a lot of the work she has done, the changes in the Church's One Foundation that are in Ever-Flowing Streams take away completely the image of Christ as the bridegroom and the church as the bride, which is a vivid and intimate portrayal of the union that takes place, although a partial image. It's certainly not the complete image of the interrelationship between Christ and the church. But I'm sure you all know the first verse as it has traditionally been sung, and it has been altered to "The church's one foundation is Christ, God's own true child, in whom the whole creation is freed and reconciled. To bring the church together, Christ lived and freely died, raised up by God forever. Christ lives to be our guide." Which is a fine text with integrity, but it does not use the same imagery or have the same depth of imagery that the text that we are familiar with has. And I don't feel that it has quite the level of excellence that the traditional text has. Another danger I think that we're in at this time is of discarding hymns and texts because they use old metaphors. In this case, I'm thinking of many of the great liturgical texts like the Te Deum and the Benedicamus and the Nunc Dimittis, which include references to the Father and use the male pronoun he often, or conclude with the traditional Trinitarian formula in the Gloria Patri. And many of us, in our zeal to reform our language, want to not use these texts at all. And I believe that we will be impoverished if we discard them completely while we're waiting for new translations from the original languages. Another danger is changing works of art to suit our new metaphors. Hymnody is poetry, and great poets over the years have put their artistic and creative power into words. And I cry for George Herbert, whose text, The Call, was included in the LBW as hymn 513, which opens with the stunning phrase, "Come my way, my truth, my life, such a way as gives us breath, such a truth as ends all strife, such a life as killeth death." But "killeth" seemed too archaic to the people who were working on the text at the time, and they changed the poetry of George Herbert to "such a life as conquers death," which is a much more meek image and not as strong and paradoxical is the idea of killing death. And that is an example of an extraordinary poem which has been altered to suit the needs of the time. It's not that I don't feel that some of these texts couldn't be misunderstood. We need to educate ourselves. But I don't feel that the solution is discarding some of these great works of art, expressions of faith that have come down to us. Because it will also cut ourselves off from the great tradition, the long procession of the church that has come down to us. We need to encourage new translations, new hymns, and new food to sustain us, using the language and metaphors of our time. But until then, shall we starve?
Thank you. Rich Anderson is going to share his viewpoint on the subject. Rich is with his wife Margaret. They are together the staff coordinators in the village. And you've been here about 2 years, Rich? Tell us how you feel.
I guess I got asked to do this because a few weeks ago I wrote a note to Carol after one of our Sunday evening Eucharists, complaining, I think, about some of the language and some of the hymns that were chosen. And she showed it to Chuck, and here I am. I'm also in a rather unfair advantage position to respond to you in your last comment about, in the meantime, will we starve? My sense has been, at least my experience in worship the last 2 years here at Holden Village, has been that the starving was happening when I was using these kinds of texts, and the excitement and any sense of rejuvenation has come from the newer, more relevant and current kinds of things that I think are being done. So there's a place, I think, to discard the old garbage so that the new stuff can grow and be created. And part of the problem, I guess, I have with a number of songs have been, I think they support and reinforce various concepts which are not part of the Christian gospel. Chuck asked me to talk about militarism. I think there's an incredible amount of militaristic, male-dominated, controlled kill-slash-burn and destroy imagery in a lot of these songs. A Mighty Fortress Is Our God is an incredible one Chuck talked about. I took about 10 minutes after dinner and paged through here, and there's songs like Let the Whole Creation Cry, Warriors Fighting for the Lord. Lord, keep us steadfast. The royal banners go forward, ride on in majesty, all glory, laud, and honor, not alone for mighty empire. Onward, Christian soldiers, God the omnipotent, on and on and on. I personally cringe and am very distracted by the violent contra-Christian messages that I sense in these songs. I don't find them beneficial at all. I find them distracting to my sense of worship. Music is probably more important to me in worship than it is to other people, some other people. And when I stumble through a song and gag on it, it has a tendency to affect my whole sense of worship. Another group of songs, I think, are very interesting are the nationalistic ones, and we really only have four of those, 566 to 569, the little group that they've sort of delegated to the very end of the book, and they, God bless our native land, God save our gracious queen, God of our fathers, and my country, tis of thee. And it's my hope that they will move these eventually out and get rid of them all. And we come to realize at some point that historically American Christianity has totally confused its sense of separateness from our nationalistic heritage. At some point I hope we're going to be able to identify that One of the major problems in the Christian church is we don't know what our God is, and we never address the fact that we are caught up in a lot of distracting false gods. Nationalism is one, capitalism is another, materialism is another, and you know, we could go on and on. So just like the American flag does not belong in the worship service arena, I don't think the nationalistic songs belong there either. Two other things I want to say. There are a number of songs in the hymnal that I think contribute to a pathological sense about the church, and that is that we exercise what we call spiritual abuse. I think people are abused spiritually by a number of things that are said or taught, and they're also abused spiritually by a number of things we sing. The song Amazing Grace That Saved a Wretch Like Me simply continues to support the worm theology that came out of the Catholic Church in the 40s and 50s and in the Lutheran Church that says we are worthless and no good and like dirt of the earth. All of that kind of stuff is spiritually destructive to people, and I think the church is suffering a great amount of unknown pain because of that. Songs like Beneath the Cross of Jesus, Alas, and Did My Savior Bleed, O Lord, throughout these 40 days, a lot of those Lenten hymns work really hard at degrading who we are as people, damaging us as individuals, helping us get some concept that we are really scum of the earth and need to look forward to Easter. My sense is we don't need any help in that area. And this kind of spiritual abuse is a real subtle problem that exists in the songs as well as the other distortions. The only other thing I'd say is that I think it's important that we identify these issues and make the changes more quickly and more radically. Otherwise, my sense is we're simply putting Band-Aids on festering sores and simply treating symptoms and not the real causes of the problems.
Thank you. Well, there must be something in what one of us said that would elicit a response from somebody out there. Now, you don't have to talk just to the three of us, and we hope you won't. We hope you'll be talking with each other across the group. But if any of you want to begin by responding to something or challenging something or applauding something that you've heard from the three of us, feel free to do that. Who's first? Yes?
Well, I don't quite understand your disagreement with Amazing Grace, because the history of, the history of that hymn is that it was written by a slave owner who had a conversion experience and freed all of his slaves, and his
the ship's captain, wasn't he, who transported slaves?
I thought he was the slave owner. I could be wrong.
Well, he was in the slave trade. He was in the slave trade anyway.
So I don't, to me that's a very powerful kind of image, so I'm not sure where I see the objection to that particular.
Well, I think maybe if the history of the song was explained every time before we sang it, then people would know and understand what they're saying.
John Newton. Yeah. The text.
My sense is that most people identify the wretch like me as you.
The singer.
Not the author of the song.
You want to come back?
I personally, they took Amazing Grace out, I'd probably leave the church.
That's a struggle I have, At what point are we going to...
It's also a hymn that's very powerful in the black community, and I don't see it as one that has been troublesome for them. I've been in too many black churches, and that particular hymn has really been a source of strength. I'll just pick on that one. I've never heard anybody complain about it.
Did you have your hand up?
Mm-hmm. It seems to me like in some of these cases you have to look at the hymn. I mean, it was written as a personal expression of someone's faith. And if you carry it too far, it becomes a form of censorship on someone's personal you know, if it's not desired, it can be excluded, but to change it, it seems like you're changing an author or a poet's.
That's part of your point, I take it, Susan. We should leave alone with their own integrity those things from the past that we've inherited. If we choose not to use them, that's our choice. But we ought not try to use them by redoing them. Is that a fair statement of your stance?
Yes, for the most part.
Yeah. There's a hand over here, I think. Yes.
I think that we need to be sensitive to the fact that some of these hymns are militaristic and are nationalistic, and we don't need that type of imagery anymore. But I think we also need to realize the history of the hymns themselves. You know, Mighty Fortress is based on Psalm 46, which talks about God being a refuge and strength, and you know, such a strong thing, where Luther translated it as a fortress, which the Hebrew says fortress as well. So, and it was written during a time, we all know the history of the Reformation, where the Turks were ready to destroy Christianity as he knew it. And it wasn't like it was some little thing going on. It was a time of great confusion, great chaos, and such like that. So a hymn like that can be very powerful at times. The hymn "Built on a Rock, the Churches Stand Even When Steeples Are Falling," written during World War II as a bombed out, you know, church, and the guy writes a hymn like that. You know, different things like that. We I think if we eliminate such hymns, we're sort of trying to deny the presence that there is a battle going on. You know, Paul talks about put on the whole armor of God. Now, are we going to censor that and sort of, well, that's kind of militaristic? Or, I mean, I can see where it can be misused and sort of overdone, but I think there's sometimes that they sensitize us to what is going on in the world. And I think that if we clean them up too much, if we sanitize them too much, then we lose the bite. I mean, we lose our edge, no pun intended. But
thank you. Others?
I think our theology is growing or progressing. Or I don't really know what word I want faster than our hymnody. And even to a certain extent, our liturgies can follow. And this distresses me somewhat, because some of the new hymns that are more inclusive and that get rid of racism or militarism and so on are not what I would call the kind of classical work of poetry that we've been accustomed to using. And so I'm really pulled, as a teacher of literature and a lover of literature, between the beautiful poetry that Susan was talking about, you know, and the strength of that poetry, and the need for inclusivity. And it's sometimes a very wrenching sort of feeling, because aestheticism is important to me.
Maybe there's a challenge here, a vocational challenge to the rising young poets of the church.
Absolutely.
To produce the new materials that are inclusive and sensitive, but are also great poetry. Mm-hmm. The new texts, yes.
We have the experience, I don't know if anyone knows the song, Thy Holy Wings.
Thy Holy Wings?
Thy Holy Wings, Gracia Grindahl, mm-hmm. has written the text to an old Swedish folk song, and it's a lovely song and lullaby, and it draws on the image of the bird, the mother bird gathering God, like a mother bird gathering the chicks and enfolding them in the nest. And it's in the Augsburg, the Sons of the People. They left out the middle verse, and they left it out, the publishers, I think probably male publishers, left out the middle verse because, and Roy called me permission from Gracia to use the hymn in a summer worship we had last summer and get the words to the middle verse that we knew there was. And why, by the way, Gracia, did that one get edited out? What happened to it? They cut it out. It was too feminine. So, I mean, and our congregation really liked it.
Mm-hmm.
They liked it a lot. But what are you to do if you're in the congregation and you're desiring well-written hymns and it appears that the powers that be or something are...
You don't define it as well-written.
So, yeah.
Incidentally, one thing we could do here tonight is share resources we're aware of. You mentioned Ruth Duck's Ever-Flowing Streams, which we've been using here. We used it tonight in Vespers. You mentioned Songs of the People, which is a collection, if I'm thinking of the right one, that has a variety of ethnic traditions represented, right?
Right.
And it's got a lot of good things in it. Kind of Hispanic things, black, Native American. Available from Augsburg Fortress, even without the missing verse.
Which we would be happy if we committed it to memory.
Can you repeat it now?
The middle verse, oh, let me nestle near thee inside thy downy breast. This is a bird.
Mm-hmm.
Inside thy downy breast, where I may find sweet comfort and peace within the nest. Oh, spread thy wings around. Keep me safely there, for I am but a newborn and need thy tender care. And this is our safe language, which was another part. I didn't hear thee and thou because we came in late. Did you say something about
Well, briefly we mentioned archaism, as, and the LBW went a little ways, but not all the way, in removing the thees and thous.
Well, that's a tough one, too, because thee and thou is not the same as you. And when we translate that as you, we've lost a dimension of the language. Mm-hmm. That connotes a different kind of relationship between God and God's people. And so if we modernize our language, we have cut out a dimension of the word.
And I had mentioned as just one example, O Master, let me walk with thee, which I grew up with, became O Master, let me walk with you. And it just doesn't sound right. Maybe that's because I grew up with it the other way. But you were mentioning one to me this morning about lettest that was changed. Weren't you? Do you remember which one that was?
The Noctimitus.
Lettest thou thy servant.
That's not the one we were talking about.
I don't think that I mentioned it.
Maybe it was someone else, but someone reflecting on a hymn we sang, I think, Sunday night, or the change in here, trying to get away from King James kind of language. The person who mentioned it was offended that that change was made, because it didn't seem necessary to her. But yeah, the Noctimitus. Instead of Lord, lettest thou thy servant depart in peace, it is now
Lord, let your servant.
Let your servant go in peace. Well, you want to talk about that for a little bit? The attempt to modernize language in terms of Old English and Newer English. You want to say something about that?
Well, I was going to say something else. I can also take that.
Well, go ahead. Go ahead with what you were going to say.
I think the familiarity of some of the old language is just so entrenched in people that it's important to keep some of those around. I mean, when I'm a Episcopal priest and I do funerals, I often just use the King James Version of the 23rd Psalm just because it's such a part of people's heritage. And I don't like the way that we've translated it, even though, I'm not saying I like it, but I'm very much in favor of inclusive language. So I think there's circumstances in which it's such a part of the history. And then the other day I was doing something with the Magnificat and we've ruined our modern translation of the Magnificat, whereas the one that people were so familiar with is just a much more beautiful piece. I think it just depends. But now I remember what I was going to say, Susan, is that my sense from you in terms of modern works and hymns is that I don't get a sense from you that there's anything worth singing And I think that that's not true. I mean, there's a lot of junk, there's a lot of really terrible stuff out there, but there's also some really good stuff being written.
If I gave that impression, I did not intend to.
Okay.
But there is a lot of junk, too.
The test of time is going to be what rises to the surface and lasts. And in the meantime, you know, we sort of have to put up with some of the junk and sort through it and find out what really works. But to not do that and to just say, well, we'll do things that were written in the 18th century, you know, I think it does stifle us. Mm-hmm.
On your point about the changes in liturgical texts, I'm in a congregation where we use every Sunday the newer English text for the Lord's Prayer. And the people who worship there are aware of that, comfortable with that, they've become comfortable with it. And our pastor thinks it's worth using for that reason, but also because he thinks it's a better translation of the original Greek. Save us from the time of trial, he thinks it's theologically sounder than lead us not into temptation. However, whenever there is a congregation present that he does not know, like at funerals, he uses the traditional text and calls for that because he says he does not want to give offense to people who may not be tuned in to the newer wording. And I think that's being sensitive in a way, too. That's a certain kind of sensitivity that I think he's employing there.
Can I throw in a counter argument? Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I think that's being placating and selling out.
Okay.
And I guess that's sort of the thing that bothered me when you talked about they took a poll in the churches and these songs were so popular that we kept them. I'm wondering when the church is going to start to realize that what's popular isn't necessarily the best thing to choose. And that maybe part of what's taking the church down the drain is the fact that we've got a comfortable pew, keep everybody happy and placate them, and don't necessarily preach the truth of the gospel, which is often quite discomforting.
That's an argument that has to be listened to, but I also hear people saying, well, but then you give that little group of editors an awful lot of power to decide. And every denomination that has tried to do a new hymnal, didn't the Methodists do a new one recently? They've all had the same experience, that the people wanted to have their say about what would be in their collection of hymns. And I think they will have their say one way or another. Even if they're wrong, they'll have their say.
But it doesn't matter what you publish, they're always going to be against it for a while.
Yeah.
I remember when we went from the Augustana black to the red, it was, you know, the church was dead. And now we went to the green, it was the same argument.
Mm-hmm.
People don't want to change.
The old rugged cross did bite the dust, though it's not in here. And that was one of the popular ones, too, that people wanted to keep.
What was the reason for that, just out of curiosity?
I think that's a
beautiful old hymn. I love it.
I don't know. I suppose
I
maybe on the grounds of sentimentality or something it was dropped. I really don't know. But it was dropped.
I appreciate what you said, Chuck, about giving the editors the power. It seems like a pretty arrogant position for somebody to sit in some spot and say, this is what the people should hear, therefore we will dictate what they will use nationally or wherever in their Sunday service. My guess is that there's different flavors to worship experiences. I mean, I don't know, when you're here at 50, there's probably, you know, a wide variety of selectivity that is used in each particular parish, such as what goes on in your parish. And I know we're struggling with this in ours, what's the right combination of more contemporary and traditional and that sort of thing. And unfortunately, we have the Lord's Prayer in the old version hammered out in stone right up above our altar. So, yeah, people say, oh, it's so gorgeous. And I think, well, yeah, well, Arnold Plotin did it.
Well, I would say to Rich that I think his point about not quite having the courage to go with what the scholars or whoever makes those decisions know is better is reflected in this book when you print both versions of the Lord's Prayer side by side. I mean, that seems to me is a concession to people aren't quite ready to make this change, so we'll give them both.
Keep everybody happy.
Is it that
much different in terms of theological? I mean, is there a reason to? Isn't that the whole problem? Is that there aren't clear lines drawn here. There is tradition, and you want to bring the tradition forward. You want to bring the modern, and you want to have that whole picture. And I don't think you want to cut yourself from tradition. And the problem is that those are gray areas. And if we had a, I think he's right. There's some issues that are not so gray that we don't take a stand on, but I'm not sure.
Let me take a quick poll here. How many of your congregations are using the creed version that has the word Catholic in it? Is it a majority? How many of you experienced some flack when that was introduced?
And continue to?
Now that's, as I understand it, that's clearly a better translation, yeah. The Church Catholic, than the Christian Church. Christian Church is a tautology. Anyway, there's only one church, it's the Christian Church. But that's what many people grew up with. Although I remember as a kid in Iowa going to Methodist services with friends, and Methodists were saying the Catholic Church way back then.
Although in that translation of the creed, I was curious as to how suddenly the Holy Spirit became a he, when before the Holy Spirit was a who.
Oh, yeah. Well, this book doesn't really do anything with God language on the gender issue.
But in the previous Nicene Creed, it was who, with the Father and the Son is worshipped and glorified, who spake by the prophets.
With the Father and the Son, he is worshiping God. Yes?
One way to get around some of these problems is, Holden's done a little bit of it, and we're moving towards this, is printing up Sunday bulletins, many churches are, which has the whole service listed on there, including hymns, and the LVW becomes somewhat redundant. The whole order of service is printed out on a sheet of paper, and there you can monkey around with language as you wish instead of pasting in over, you know, in the hymn books and that sort of thing. And we've done this in summer outdoor worship where we've just printed everything and people don't have their hymn books. We're moving towards that now inside. And I've seen a number of congregations that have dealt with some of these issues without making it so obvious that there's big changes.
But there's a danger in that.
That sounds kind of sneaky.
I don't disagree with the idea. I certainly think that the changes have to be made. But we are a church. You know, I think we become a little autonomous communities that are separate from when we start doing that. You know, and I think that the changes probably need to be made or worked towards in a broader level so that we maintain our interdependence and our sense of community. And I think I want to be just point I was thinking of earlier is that I think we have to be careful about what we say about editors and the people who work for the publishers, because there's so much more involved than we could know. And, you know, I was just to laugh at the mysterious they that everybody refers to, they did this, they did that. We forget that they do operate out of a sense of we. That's really a very difficult and hard thing for them to have to do. But they've also got sales. You know, I hate it, but sales dictates a lot more than we'd like to admit. And if they print something one way and it doesn't sell, they lose a lot of money and they can't continue operating. So it's a much broader thing than just blaming editors and the few, the mysterious they in Minneapolis or Philadelphia, wherever they are now. Minneapolis.
Yeah. Not only do they lose money, it doesn't get used.
Right.
If people don't buy it,
it
doesn't get used.
You know, I think had they, and it's sad, and it's a real tension that I feel as a church musician selecting hymns. And we did a hymn poll in my church to find out, mainly because I want to get them to sing. You know, that's my struggle. I've been there 2 years, and we've got to open their mouths. So I said, what do you like to sing? And Honor Christian Soldiers is right, I think, number two. Mm-hmm. And we did it one Sunday, and I just gagged. Yeah, I was with you on that. And I looked out, and there was our Vietnam vet who was having flashbacks and problems. And I thought, we cannot do this hymn anymore. But it's a struggle, because had we not included that in that book, or a lot of the things they included, or what you call sellout, we'd still be in the SBH in most of the churches. Mm-hmm. You know, and the LDW was a big step from the SBH, at least.
But it was a compromise.
Yeah.
Also, as I think any collection for the whole people of God will be. Does anybody know where the committee that is working on a revision of the liturgical texts is currently in their work? I understand there is a group working on a revision of the liturgical texts, particularly with regard to gender.
What type of?
Which wouldn't be all that hard to fix.
God language, or what type of?
Yeah, I think it's basically God language that they're working on. For example, one change that I more and more make myself when I sing it, just because it feels right, it is right to give him thanks and praise. It is right to give God thanks and praise. It just seems to come naturally to me now, but it still says in here, it is right to give him thanks and praise. That kind of change, I understand, is being worked on for some supplement or maybe a revised edition of this. You know that hymnals in the life of most churches last about 20 years. That's about their life. This was 58, this was 78. So maybe in 98 there'll be another. And we're over halfway there. Yes, Jan?
Do you know if anyone is working on or with Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza's work and others who have resurrected the women of the Bible, the women who were probably heads of churches and so on, and are never referred to in litanies and other prayers of the church? Is anyone doing this sort of
thing? I don't know nothing about it. Does anyone else know?
Because I would, you know, it seems a shame that there would be a review of gender without providing the role models that are so necessary. It's one thing to use she and he, and another thing to include Joanna with Paul and so on, or Sarah with Abraham.
I hear worship leaders these days more and more including Sarah with Abraham, just almost automatically, it seems. But beyond that, not much.
That's a pretty easy one, but yeah. Some of the New Testament figures are more difficult.
Mm-hmm. I have right here what we're going to send to press pretty soon, and that's a redone LBW service that we're going to use at Holden to do exactly what you talked about, and we're going to include in it the confession that we have on the inside back cover of the hymnal. We fixed a few spots in the hymn of praise. For instance, this is the feast of victory for our God, for the Lamb who was slain has begun to reign. We took out the Nicene and Apostles' Creed and put in a different one.
The Athanasian, I suppose.
Great.
By popular acclaim.
No.
By popular demand.
The Reader's Digest version.
Did the what you mentioned with it is right to give God thanks and praise, which already we fixed in the LBWs here at Holden. We offer several alternative beginnings for the Lord's Prayer, Abba Ima, Daddy Mommy, and Our God. And then the spot that I think is the worst problem in the current LBW settings is the post-communion canticle, Thank the Lord. And we are putting in here a version that was put together at University Lutheran in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It was Thank the Lord with songs of praise, tell everyone what God has done, let everyone who seeks the Lord rejoice and proudly share the word. God renews the promise of life and leads us forth in peace and joy with shouts of thanksgiving. Hallelujah.
Carol, I notice at Holden, with all the changes, that Lord is pretty much left alone. Is Lord not a problem for people here?
We've, at least not in the last year, had many people objecting to that. And I think when you tackle that one, it does introduce just a whole new host of problems.
The other one that I think leads to a lot of problems is to try to get rid of the sex of Jesus, the gender of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And some argue that we need to do that. You want to talk about that a little bit? Seems to me it's very clear biblically that Jesus was a male.
Yeah, I mean, he was circumcised on the eighth day, so
yeah.
It's kind of hard to...
Yes.
That's an off-Friday word,
though. I can't think about that.
Please.
You're going to hate me in the room, and I don't want to mean to be unliberated. But I have a question with that as far as I am all for changing mankind to humankind. I mean, I'll fight for that one. And I'm all for seeing both the male and female sides of God, that God has both female qualities and male qualities, and that I can't limit God. But I have problems with taking Jesus' sexuality away as if that was wrong that he was a man. Is the reasoning that maybe some women might have a trouble relating to Jesus as a man? I mean, because I could see where that some people could have problems with that. Is that what the emphasis is to moving it to more inclusive language of Christ?
I don't know. Anybody want to respond to her on that?
Jesus was not a male in the macho sense in any way. He didn't hunt. He didn't fish. He didn't drive a chariot.
He fished.
He fished. That was his sport. He fished.
No, to eat, I guess. Yeah.
And his responses to people are as feminine as they are masculine.
Yes.
And I see no objection to presenting that side of the Christ as clearly as we possibly can, as well as his masculine side, which he was a male, there's no question about that, but he did not carry all of the masculine characteristics that made him apart from the female, who, with the caring, the loving, the compassion, and things that men are, in our society at least, are not considered supposed to exhibit.
I have a problem with that, because that's stereotyping men as not being compassionate. I mean, I don't hunt, I don't drive a chariot, and I don't... And our society tends to stereotype so much, and I have a problem with this, you know, Christ was not the archetypical male image in America, but maybe that speaks more fully of what of not stereotyping into. I mean, I have a problem with people who say, well, love, compassion, empathy, sensitivity are feminine characteristics that are more of a feminine side. I really have a problem with that, because I don't feel that those are gender specific issues. I feel no gender is more one way than the other. And this is our thing.
Okay.
Another way we've sorted that out is to make a distinction between the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith. And to look, we had an inclusivity committee this year at Holden that met real regularly and tried to deal with some hymn texts and rewrite them. And we would find ourselves, in using that criteria, looking at a text and trying to figure out, now, is this the Jesus of history, that historical person bound by time, or is this the Christ of faith who lives on and God's continuing redeeming presence in that second person of the Trinity that's being spoken of here? And in that way, deciding whether we need to take out the male reference. Now, however, that's not a distinction that everybody agrees with. And on my way over here, I had to cut short a conversation with Michael Pellett, who would say that that's docetism and that not all would agree on that distinction. And I think it'd be interesting to talk more about that.
I take it the first viewpoint you expressed distinction, has the eternal Logos, who is from the beginning, with what we used to call the Father, that's genderless, the eternal Logos. But Jesus, the incarnate human person in whom God dwelt, is male. Mm-hmm. Is that the distinction? Then the resurrected Christ is genderless again?
Yeah, I think that isn't, the Christ of faith is not gender specific, whereas the Jesus of history, of incarnational Jesus, is.
Go ahead.
What's docetism?
I can't give you a quick summary on that. Anybody?
What's the,
that's denying like the incarnation, saying that sort of like God, well, Jesus wasn't really a man.
Didn't really happen. It was
he didn't really, he pretended to be a person.
It's the Greek word is to appear. Mm-hmm. I think for dokeo, yet he appeared to be a human.
He seemed to be a human.
But he wasn't actually in the flesh. Really, it was just sort of a spirit floating through the world doing this drama that is recorded in the Bible. Didn't actually suffer, didn't actually bleed, just sort of.
And that's
the denial of the humanity.
Right. And that's why John was in John's gospel. He put in, and he became flesh and dwelt among mm-hmm. us to. Because he wrote it right during the height of that influence, and he wanted to make sure that Christians weren't gonna, there was no question in their minds that, well, this is God in the flesh, not just appeared, you know, not just seemed.
I keep forgetting to look up above. If there are people up there who want to speak, yell out. Yes.
How many people here find that in their congregations there are people who just really don't care?
About the changes?
They care about changes, but that they really don't care about inclusive language. In fact, they're kind of vaguely offended by it, and I guess I find that it's mostly women that are sometimes more than vaguely offended by it.
I've found that, yeah.
And downright crazy over it. They are also part of the church. One can try to educate, etc., but I don't know. I mean, I find
so
myself
offended?
Grieved to hear that the creed has been dropped. Now, I can come to Holden and happily worship in a different way without a creed. But week after week after week, I would be grieved to see that dropped.
To see the Nicene,
the historical creeds dropped. I would be grieved over that. Maybe could become emotional. No, if that's my response to the creed, then, you know, and I think that's a legitimate response to that. I mean, is it not legitimate of them to say, I really don't care, and you're offending, taking away something near and dear to me by tinkering with all this stuff? Who are we to say we have to be inclusive?
Well, see, that's the tension right there, because we have pastoral and the prophetic as leaders in the church, and to try to maintain a balance there is something that I really struggle with, especially with this issue.
Some people have caused great harm with it. In the last churches I served in, as a deaconess, they had an intern who was a woman and was kind of militaristic about her inclusive language use. And so now, a lot of the women in the congregation don't want to have anything to do with it because she turned them off, you know, that's kind of how they put it, which I think can happen, you know, when we make changes without love and without consideration for people's histories. But then there's the problem of challenge. And what is real love? You know, tough love? Or let them be the way they are forever and ever?
Carol, did you say that the Apostles and Nicene Creeds would not be in the Revised Liturgy of the Eucharist?
That's our plan at this point. We're still working on modifications, but
what would you
people react real strongly to it. So we have an affirmation of faith that we took from one of Ray McKeever's liturgies. I'll read it if you want to see it. We believe in God, the giver of life, who created the earth and all that exists. We believe in God, the redeemer of life, who was revealed to the people of Israel in their journey from oppression to freedom, who was revealed in Jesus the Christ in his birth and death, his pain and resurrection, and who is revealed to us in our own joys and sorrows. We believe in God, the sustainer of life, who heals us in our pain, who gives us new life in our dying, and through whom we are made whole in our resurrection.
Okay.
One possibility I'm considering is to put in another option. You know, like we do with the McKeever service when we use it here, we have three creedal options at that point in the service to put in the Nicene Creed. This one and maybe another one that's a little different than this in its newness.
Rich, say it out loud.
Same problem as the green book. Give them lots of choices and keep them all happy.
Mm-hmm. But
pretty soon it's going to be, you know, McDonald's smorgasbord for worship.
But do you really think that including the traditional creeds with changed language would be a pop-out and a sell-out and a smorgasbord?
Well, I think if they're struggling to do something that's new, to throw everything in there so that you don't offend anybody, I think is a cop-out to the goal of creating something new and relevant.
But perhaps offense is not the motivation. Perhaps the motivation is to retain the ties with the community of saints as they have come to us in the life of the church.
I think
what it does is just point out the limitations of the language. We have no words to explain God, and that's the problem. That you need, talking about Creator is fine, but it's not the same image as Father. And that is a difficult image to deal with. I mean, we don't have any perfect way of saying that. And the choices, I think, can say, we don't have one way of saying it. The language is too limiting for something that is beyond language. That's something that I've looked at inclusive language. It makes me look at what my image of God is, and it makes me see how language has limited that image. But for me, you know, to admit that there is no language that is right and perfect is a theological insight.
It's true even apart from the gender issue.
Yeah.
Because what you're saying, yeah, none of our language is adequate, ever,
and
to capture God.
And I think that's what the inclusive issue
apart
points
from,
up.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't pretend that it answers it. You know, that it answers it.
Yes.
I think the issue of inclusivity we shouldn't just get rid of all the male things and then bring more female imagery. We should make use of the variable images throughout the Bible. There's not just male and female. There's all kinds of, you know, animal imagery and other types of imagery of buildings, you know, fortress or a house or, you know, things
the
like that.
God of eagle's wings.
Yeah, right. I mean, yeah, we sang it this morning.
Yeah.
I mean, we shouldn't try to just, well, that's overused. Let's get rid of it. We should include them all. And that way being inclusive.
Which would mean occasionally we could say Our Father.
Yeah, we could use all the different images. Instead of just, I mean, I admit we kind of overdid it with the Father. I mean, that gets to be redundant sometimes, but that's not the only one in there. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of other images that I don't think we really have tapped yet. Much more vital. And if we get to just a God image, just like just God and nothing else to sort of compare it, God to,
you know, metaphors.
Yeah, metaphor. Yeah. If we lose all our metaphors, then what, you know, what can we really, you know, God is like, well, God is God. He's not like anything. God's just God. And then what do
He's
we
not.
Have?
I don't think that's the problem. I think that's the beauty of it. You know, if you ask me, if you can't grab it, it's a testimony of faith. And to call it a problem, I think, is, you know, I don't see it that way. Maybe it's one of the jokes.
Yes.
Well, this is just echoing pretty much what you said, I guess, but expanding the language and adding on things, I guess the dropping things creates so much terror in the church that, I think I've just been doing this for too long. I've burned out. I'd rather add things than deal with the plaque that comes in, you know, because you're constantly annihilating things. add new Eucharistic prayers and new hymns and stuff like that.
My sense is that the Anglican Communion had as much of an upset with changes in the Book of Common Prayer as any of our traditions have had with any new books of worship. You want to say something about that?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, we still have people threatening to leave. There's this incredible organization, the 1928 Prayer Book Society, and they're just wild-eyed, you know. There are people who still use the 28 Prayer Book.
Which was basically King James English, right?
It's much more than that. It's much more than the language. We've tried to go back and recover the early Eucharistic traditions of the church translating earlier prayers that are just totally unfamiliar to people. The 28 Prayer Book it's just totally different. I don't know how different your two books are. Ours barely resemble each other, which is good. My opinion has created great stress in people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Chuck, one of the books that I had Mary order this summer is Sally McFaig's Models of God. And in there, she presents a metaphorical systematic theology. And if one goes through the discipline of reading that book, you come out at the other end not only introduced to, in a very comfortable way, to God as both Father and Mother, but also to seeing ourselves as fathers and mothers of the earth. And then we approach God through ourselves and see that in us which is Father and Mother. It's really a remarkable new approach to it. Rather than starting with God and coming this way, we start with ourselves and become colleagues with God in the whole loving, befriending, mothering, fathering process.
That book is on the table of books recommended by summer teaching.
Well, that's
staff,
the one I had.
Yeah, and you're recommending it.
Well, that's the one I recommended.
Title?
Pardon?
Title?
Models of God.
Author?
Sally McFaig.
McFaig.
McFaig. She was the dean of Vanderbilt Divinity School and is now back to teaching systematics there.
And you've obviously found it quite helpful.
I and others.
Second tier? Yes.
Coming back to the militarism, I guess if you understand that in terms of the two kingdoms, that there is this raging war between the forces of good and evil, or forces of darkness and light, if you understand it in that sense, I don't see anything wrong with it. If you understand it in terms of nationalism, nation against nation, or neighbor against neighbor, then certainly it doesn't reflect the Christian life. But there is that struggle internally, spiritually, the war that goes on spiritually between forces of good and evil, dark and light. And there's, that's a reality in our spiritual life. There's nothing wrong with singing about that in our worship either. But I think there needs to be some education, of course, with it. Because when we hear those, we think in terms of military hardware instead of spiritual hardware. Another issue, too, is the flag. I know we had... former congregation I served, the biggest issue we struggled with at our annual meeting was the flag. And we had, the veterans.
Flag in the sanctuary or in the chancel?
Yeah. In the chancel. And I thought that we came out with a pretty good compromise there. We would bring the flag in at the time of Pentecost, the Sunday after Pentecost. And we'd take the flag out at the beginning of Advent. Because during the time from Advent until Pentecost, the focus of the church here is on Jesus, his life and ministry. The time of the seasons of the Sunday after Pentecost, you focus on your life as a church in the world and where we're planted as the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. This is where we do our ministry. And so the focus isn't to worship the flag, but to tell us this is where we do our ministry. So again, I don't see anything wrong with that. It's just focusing where we're doing our work as a church.
I'd like to add that there's another source that really came out too late to be incorporated into our Holden book selection in the store and so forth for this year, but that's Thomas Berry's Dream of the Earth, which Sierra Club has just published. It's their first publication in their new Nature and Philosophy series. And in there, he reminds us that we're moving from a patricentric to a matricentric to an omnicentric kind of world. And when we talk about inclusivity, we would probably do better to start with cosmic inclusivity and work backward, because then everything becomes natural. When you look at the whole, then you go back and start seeing all the pieces fit together, that we are a species among species. And then men and women seem to come together more easily, and the father and mother qualities of God come together. I think that what we need to avoid is an anthropocentric kind of language and move more toward that omnicentric language, so that at least our liturgical language would become more earthy. I think that would be very helpful in our time. Rather than starting with the man-woman kind of thing, to begin with the whole earth of which we're a part, and balances come more easily, I think.
Go ahead.
That's a wonderful theoretical sort of approach to take there. And isn't the source for our anthropocentric language and worldview, though, the scriptures, which are so heavily anthropocentric, at least the approach to the scriptures, which we claim to be our central book, the approach that I was taught, reads it much more anthropocentrically than it does omnicentrically. Well, I mean, the Colossians passage, certainly a few others, are of that ilk.
Our scriptures really are rooted in 3500 BC, when Europe went from a matricentric kind of community to a patricentric community. So our scriptures reflect what was going on, rather than create it, and they simply help to contribute to it and sustain it and so forth. And that's where we need to begin to look toward theory that can move us away. Because I don't know where else we begin. We have to start with theory, because there is nothing substantial to deal with there.
I think we have a lot of images that come to us outside of the scriptures too. The mystics have given us such wonderful images for God. Meister Eckhart talking about God as a great underground river. It's a wonderful image for God. And I don't think that, as I don't believe that God's revelation and inspiration stopped at the end of what we consider the Holy Bible, I feel that we are able to draw images from those people who have been inspired by God since that time. And there are a great many writers and wonderfully creative people who draw, as Dick was saying, from the whole cosmic picture. And that would be a wonderful place to start. We start so puny. We start with our puny selves and try to encompass God. You're right.
Anyone else? Any untouched categories? Yes.
I hadn't been involved in thinking of it this way before, but you brought it up. The looking at God as a cosmic force. What happens to our prayers? Are we then praying to a concept? Are we just praying back to ourselves, or I mean, what is this? Why, where is God in prayers? We go to a cosmic entity. I realize Father God can be, that's pretty limiting in itself.
You're asking.
I want to pray to a cosmic, to a nothingness, and everything nothingness, or who knows what reverberates into the ground. Or
may the force
You're asking,
yeah.
Depersonalizing God, or taking away the sense of intimacy, is that the concern?
Yes. Are you praying towards the source, or change our praying so we're only praying to the Lord? I guess we looked at the triune as the way our prayers have been. I'm concerned about that too.
Most people would find it hard to pray to Tillich's O great ground of our being.
Yeah.
Same idea.
But, you know, does praying to the Creator, Sustainer, Redeemer, I mean, is that, I guess I've always liked that language, but now that you bring that up, I wonder if that, is it,
Which God is that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you've made me think that maybe that's not the answer necessarily either.
Well, they're metaphors, but so is father and mother metaphor.
But they're personal. I mean, but they're, father and mother is that personal.
That's
like
right.
Creator,
it's more of a personal metaphor, yeah.
And, great force of our world.
Maybe, but for me, father, mother is limited.
Oh, it is.
And that this kind of concept is all pervasive.
But it adds a dimension that creator doesn't. I mean, a parent, yes, is part of the creation, but it continues to nurture it. I mean, that's the part that I think we
But see,
know.
Well, the difficulty I have is that it doesn't give us a creation sense, that we are part of the creation, that it's the earth and all of it that nurtures us. And so we go about our ecological havoc destroying that part of the creation that really is the nurturing part of the, you know, the thing that we're all part of. I mean, last week Jerry Barney was here and talked about theological ecological concerns, and that we don't have a theology that encompasses the earth as a part of the real creation and us as a part of all of that either. And we've gone ahead with the Genesis stuff about we are to dominate and have dominion over.
I guess I'd have to disagree with, I didn't go to that person's forum, but I'd have to disagree with that we're not part of the creation as far as taking care, or that we haven't had a theology, but because the Bible, I mean, the whole theology of Israel is that you don't own the land, I'm giving it to you, you're not your own. You don't own yourselves. You don't own your bodies. You're here to. Adam and Eve are planted and put in a garden to take care of it and to keep it. And it's not. It's a gift to use. You know, as stewards, we're not consumers of the world. We're stewards. And I think it. You know, we can. I think that's our perception of. I mean, that's the way it is. We see ourselves as consumers and. We're not taking care of it, but I don't think it's from the scriptural way. So I think the Bible is pretty clear on that, as who owns the world and who's supposed to take care of it and our responsibility. So I think,
I don't disagree with that. Yeah. I guess I'm talking about from a practical standpoint of, is the church really pushing that?
Yeah,
and I think if anything
were,
you know, how can the church stand up and say that, and then we go down and have coffee and styrofoam cups and all this other kind of destructive things that we buy.
Talk about the earth well.
It's probably safe to state that for Lutherans at least, the Lutheranism in which I grew up, we were preoccupied with the second article, with redemption, with Christ. And we spent precious little time preaching and teaching about the implications of the creation of the first article. I think that's beginning to change. Gerald Barney's question is whether it's going to change in time, you know, whether we've got time to do that work and catch up with where we ought to have been. But I think as a Lutheran, I would have to say that we've been practically Unitarians of the second article for a long time, and maybe ever since the Reformation period.
Going back to the question about then who do we pray to, what God are we praying to, I think implied in that is the idea that we have to choose one metaphor or another. We either have to choose God as father or mother, or we have to choose God as the source of all being and the cosmic river. But I don't think we have to choose either one or the other. I think that we can choose many of the metaphors for God and not have to say either this one is right or that one is right, but both this one and this one are right, because we don't know within the limits of our understanding how to really describe God. And all of these things are metaphors, and I don't see why we have to choose, but I think we can embrace all of them.
We have to, for the simple reason that we can't deny a cosmic God, and we can't deny a God who takes care of, the, or who is the creator of the world. But we also cannot deny the fact that a person who, in this group, was facing cancer, or just had half his family killed and then burned in the house, or whatever it might be, you'd have to believe that something happens when we pray to that God that relieves us personally of part of our burden, at least. And something does happen when we pray, and that's the whole interesting part of it, that the true Christian knows that whatever cosmic forces are at work in the mind of God, that he also cares for each of us personally and deals with our problems in a very personal and a very powerful way. So you can't do one image. You can't do, and I'm just agreeing with what you said, really, but I'm trying to personalize it to what we have to think and what we have to believe in order to maintain ourselves as Christians.
Okay?
I'd like to make
one. Go ahead, and then, yeah. Rich.
There's just all this feminine imagery, just like the women in the Bible, that have been ignored and not been used. And that's what we just need to incorporate that more. And it's there.
It's about a restoration of a balance,
yeah,
that we've neglected.
Like, we have a new Eucharistic prayer that they're still fighting about in church, but it'll make it. We're talking about one of the images forgotten when Jesus says, as a hen gathers her chicks and the mm-hmm. wings, you know, that made it into the Eucharistic prayer. It's just we have not made use of those images. So,
but they are in the scriptures.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, yeah, well, that's great. Right.
Rich?
Just an interesting non-inclusive comment about tonight's discussion. Knowing many of you, there's at least 14 clergy in this room, and my guess is that the clergy have dominated most of this discussion. I haven't taken a real poll, but clergy, seminary students, or past clergy have been probably the most aggressive in this discussion, and I'm not sure what that says, except I think it's a little frightening. And I'm one of the clergy.
I don't know, because I don't know who's clergy and who isn't, except for those who identify themselves in that role. I'm not clergy, but I have a seminary degree. You're not clergy, I take it. So I don't know.
I didn't count you in my numbers.
Okay, good. I'm glad. I'm not one of the 14.
I think it speaks to the issue that the real important factor is not convincing of just in the conceptions of God that in congregations, you know, that are of traditional Lutherans, that this is an issue which offends a lot of people, and that people are not open to it right now, and the importance of education, because I think people are pretty well of one mind in you know, seminarians and people who studied the issue and who know the Greek and or Hebrew texts, but when you get down to interrelated people more who don't have come with that mm-hmm. background, that baggage mm-hmm. of knowledge, then it's a very emotional issue, because mm-hmm. it's an issue of change and of things that they are now open to. And I think the real challenge for the church is to know how to communicate that. And, you know, and this issue dealt with a much higher level of a lot of jargon, theological jargon, that frankly is meaningless to most lay Christians. Yeah. Doetism and whatnot. You know, I mean, that's...
How do you make the jump between, you know, I'm talking as just a person of faith. In prayer, I'm still not completely comfortable with certain addressing God in certain ways. And I don't really know why. Just when I hear it, it's like, oh, that's not my God, or, you know, and I have a problem with, I guess, who is my God then, or who are these people praying to? And, you know, our God doesn't have a name, right? And there's a reason for that, right? Because we don't control God. That's why, you know, I am who I am. But it's an emotional issue, it's a personal issue, and I would like to know if there's some formula for making the jump. You know, does it just gradually in time you become more comfortable and familiar once you understand up here the reasons for it?
It's an interesting point you made that I had not thought about until just now, that the God of the ancient Hebrews did not have a name, and I presume did not have a pronoun either then. I don't know. But God was not supposed to be named originally among the people of Israel, right? When they asked God's name, God said, I am who I am.
So maybe this whole discussion is an issue of faith that we're supposed to deal with, and there's more to it than just what we call God. You know, it goes deeper than that. I don't know.
Good insight. Another thing we didn't really touch on tonight, and I don't suggest we go into it now, but I want to mention at least, is there's probably a distinction that we all make between our own private prayer life and our collective, corporate life of worship, where we have to inevitably take into consideration the feelings, the attitudes, the shaping of all others who are there with us. And Holden too does that, I think. But at least to me, there is that distinction that we probably all make. And some things we would do in our private devotional life probably wouldn't work or wouldn't fit comfortably in our corporate worship life.
Linked to both of those issues is, to me, it's so much a matter of habit and what we're used to. I remember the first time I started praying with a group that was not my congregation, saying, our mother, our father, who are in heaven, you know, it just took me, I really liked it, but it took me a while to get used to it. Now, that's, you know, that's in my mind, regardless of what, you know, we say in the church, but it's just getting used to the change. At least that's what it was for me, but that's for so many people who have trouble with it. But there are differences between what we do publicly and what we do with people that, you know, support ideas. We're not going to fight that. You know.
Well, I'm glad we've tied up all the loose ends. And we won't have to talk about this again for another day or two. It's one of those subjects that keeps surfacing at every time I'm at Holden, it's being talked about, and we'll continue to talk about it. So thanks to all of you. If any of you want to stick around in little clusters and continue, feel free to do that. But I think we'll call the session over at this point. Thank you. Thanks to you.